Hello, and welcome to Writers Group Therapy.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Roshni. We're writers helping writers with whatever writing ailments you might have.
Whether it's related to your craft or your career, we can help.
Are you ready for your session?
The doctors are in. It's that time again. It is the end of our year, end of our like school year. For Writers Group Therapy, end of year six. Congratulations for making it this far, Roshni.
Is this really year six for us? I thought we were further along than that. Oh my gosh, only 6 years.
Well, 173 episodes, including this one so far.
Man.
Yeah, it's been a while, huh?
We lost 3 years with the pandemic, but then it also feels longer at the same time. So I have no sense of time anymore.
Yeah, they all start to blend together, just kind of a big blur. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
But it's been a busy time, especially for you. You have done so much in the last year, and the culmination of a lot of that work is the launch of your third book in the Kingdom Legacy series.
Whew.
The Heir of Magic and Mischance is out. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you.
So how does it feel to have, I mean, when you have a third book, that's like now it's a trilogy kind of thing. It's not just a one-off. It's not just a two-off. It's like, it's a series.
It's a series and it's not done. I'm aiming for seven minimum, so we'll see. So at the very least seven, because there's seven kingdoms, and then there might be like spinoffs or something. It's funny because I actually have a duology not related to this series that I really want to write, but I know I need to finish this series. So I'm kind of like chafing at the bit to get the series done so I can move on, but like you also want to write well. So
do authors always finish one series before they start another? Is that like a
thing? I mean, not necessarily, but I guess I feel like I have to, or I should.
I was thinking when you said that, I immediately thought of Star Trek, because when The Next Generation came out in the 80s, it ran for seven seasons, but they started the next series about four or five seasons in, so they overlapped. So they had another series, and that one ran for seven seasons, and then the first series ended, and then 4 or 5 years into the second show of the franchise, they started Star Trek Voyager. So they kind of had this rolling, they were always getting new fans for the new thing while the old one was wrapping up.
Oh, I didn't know. That's so weird. But they didn't have the same cast or the same writers, did they?
No, but they were in the same universe. So they were able to roll, you know, kind of like connect the shows that way a little bit, you know, have a little bit of overlap. Only on occasion did characters go from one show to the other. It was only very few times did that happen.
Oh, that's interesting. That must have been confusing. Yeah. But were they the same timeline or whatever? Or like...
Yeah, they were happening in the same timeline, actually. So you had basically, you know, we're basically spinning off in the same universe another story. So unlike you, which is, you know, you're doing books, obviously, so it's different. You know, you're creating one world with this series, and then your other series is going to be a completely different thing.
Yeah.
Unconnected. So it's not the same. I mean, in the TV world, that's, you know, for spinoffs, that's basically how you move a fan base from one to the other, but those are generally spinoffs, which have, like you said, some characters are the same, or the world is the same, but it's a different area. I think they did that with like CSI and CSI Miami. They had like the lead from CSI Miami showed up in Vegas, and that's how they started it or something.
Well, CSI is funny because there's like a bazillion spinoffs anyway, and I feel like all of those crime shows that they're like running out of ideas. I'm like, pretty soon it'll be like CSI Boise, Idaho. Boise, Idaho. Or, you know,
Boise,
CSI,
Idaho, yeah.
Like, you know, middle of Canada
Mansfield.
Or something. Yeah.
Whatever,
today another goat died or something.
Well, that's a good question then. So what is different about book three, The Heir of Magic and Mischance, from your other two books?
Well, I feel like the series is getting darker, for one thing. I mean, and you're the editor, so you probably can attest to that. They're getting longer, too. I'm actually in promotions, again, for book one, and I think it's like 272 or 292. And I think the newer books are clocking in at like 320, 350 page-wise. So they're getting longer, for sure. And yeah, I think they're just getting darker because book three kind of ends on a, it's not really a cliffhanger, but it's sort of a nebulous kind of ending. I don't know what you call it. There's definitely, yeah, it's not a neatly tied bow at the end.
I've read the book, obviously, so spoilers if I say anything spoilerific, I'll try not to, but there are some characters referenced in this book and some of the characters in this book from previous books. But do you intend to weave those together more as you go forward? Will there be a, will the seventh book bring in connections to all the books before it?
So it's funny you say that. I actually posted this on Goodreads because it wasn't until I finished book three that, okay, so this is not a spoiler, but the series is set in an area called the Gifted Lands, and there are seven kingdoms, and each kingdom has like a specialty. And when I first started writing it, I went into this without a show Bible, guys. I'm sorry. I'm a horrible writer. I'm a pantser. What can we say? So there was no outline. There was no show Bible. I really didn't know like what the arcs were going to be. And I had an idea for the first two books is like, this is what the kingdom is like. This one is focusing on Rothschan, which is a military kingdom. And I honestly didn't really delve too much into like what the kingdom is like so much as like how it affects people from that kingdom. And then as I finished book three and I'm starting book four, and I'm really excited about book four, although I feel like I've written myself into a corner at this point, I had an idea for book seven that's going to tie them all together. And so seven's going to be, yeah. And seven is the kingdom we know nothing about because I know nothing about it. It's kind of like the mystery kingdom on the map. But based off of events in books three and four, let's say, I think it's going to make everybody come together in book seven.
Okay. Cool. Well, in this book, in book three, we actually go back to Kalia, which is the main location of the, well, one of the main locations of the first book. So we do get a lot of Princess Jenica and her lady in waiting, Taryn, and some of the other characters from that book. So, you know, if you read the first book, you're going to have some I don't want to say fan service, but you're going to get to see some familiar characters, which is great. And we get to see some action, which is always nice. And then you get this real personal story of Adeline, the main character, and her journey. And why don't you talk about her a little bit and what your thinking was behind creating her?
So with Adeline, that one was funny. This, I'll be honest, I feel like book three was really hard for me to write. And with how many drafts you and I went back and forth on, and I know you were so patient with me. I think there were times you were probably ready to just burn my manuscript. So this one was a hard one for me to write because the original thought was, so it's the military kingdom. They believe more in rational thinking and science and what you can see versus like magic, which is more esoteric and, you know, kind of out there, right?
It's almost heretical to them, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And I was going to focus on that originally. Like, that was supposed to be the point, and it didn't go that way. And so I think there was, you probably felt that push and pull when you were reading early drafts, because I was like, it should go this way, but it's going this way because, again, I'm a pantser and it wants to go that direction. So with Adeline, well, it's on the blurb, so this is not a spoiler. She comes from a country that hates magic, and she discovers that she has that ability. And so what that means for her being from a place where she should hate herself and she should hate what she is and what she could become, and discovering that there's a bigger world beyond what she has always wanted to be a part of, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. She had a plan at the beginning of the book that was completely thrown apart. It was just literally exploded.
Yeah.
And had to like go on the run and discover herself along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's funny too about book three is I'm still learning a ton about marketing. And I feel like I've learned more than I did than I had with book one, but not enough to make it like feasible or like workable yet. So I'm at that point where they say, if you want to do book marketing well, you should have a couple books under your belt for the back catalog. So now I'm at that point, right? I have a back catalog.
Right.
And it is so much trial and error. I feel like promoting a film is so much easier, maybe because we did so much of it earlier. Book marketing is a lot. It's a very different beast. It's such a different beast.
Yeah. Are there like contests for books and stuff, like film festivals, or
there are book festivals,
I assume.
Yeah, there are book competitions. There's always short story competitions and stuff like that. And there's also just like with film, with scripts, you can submit your script and hopefully a producer picks it up and wants to produce it and you get a little bit of money. There's the same thing with like manuscripts and whatnot. I haven't determined yet if it's worth the time or the effort. And the other thing too is I feel like I keep hitting them, those particular contests, at the wrong time. It's not that, I don't want to say it's not that hard, because it is hard, but it's not that time consuming to knock out a 22-page comedy script, spec script for a fellowship. You can sit down and do that in a weekend and be fairly decent and get it out. But it is a lot harder to have a completed manuscript in time for a competition. You know what I'm saying? And it's ready to go. And you're like, okay, like if I'm sitting on a manuscript for that long, I'm probably going to publish it and they don't want it published. Or you just have this manuscript that's sitting around waiting to be part of a competition. And that's a lot of pages.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're one of several friends of mine who are self-published novelists. And it seems like you all have a similar problem. You all have really good books, but you just trying to reach that critical mass is the trickiest part, and then to get the message out. And you're competing with a lot of other materials. I mean, I just walked through the bookstore last week, and you know, there's just so many titles on the shelves, and I've never heard of any of them. And you know, it's amazing that anybody sells any books these days. So it's kind of daunting, but you keep going, and what, you know, what have you learned along the way is like about the persistence of this, about the tenacity you have to have.
Whew. Well, obviously always put your best work out there. Like there is a reason I think publisher books take like a year or two or more to be released, right? Because it's not just the drafting, it's the editing, it's the revisions, it's the beta readers, it's the, you know, testing. And so in theory, you want to be able to put out a lot of content at a high volume, but sometimes you can't. Right now, I'm averaging one book a year. I'm kind of on like a publisher schedule, even though I'm a self-pub. You know what I'm saying? Like I'm on a traditional publisher schedule versus an indie publisher schedule. I should be churning out more content. But when you do that, unless you're really confident in what you're putting out, there are some indie authors that I love and I will buy their books, but I can tell when they've skimped on editing, and I can tell when they just kind of threw together two or three drafts and they threw it out there, because I catch the errors, or you catch where the story's weak and you're like, oh, you should have spent more time on this. But I know why you did it. Because as indies, we're taught put out as much content as possible. So I would still say put your best book forward. One thing which obviously I did not do because of how I published, I've heard people say maybe write one or two or three books and then have them ready to go. So like before you even publish, have say three books ready, and then publish one, you know, January, publish one in June, publish one the next January, just so you have that production schedule, but you already had them ready to go. I don't know if I could have waited that long, because that would have been like a 3 or 4 year process at this point. Yeah.
That brings up the question. It's like, do you feel like self-publishing versus going the traditional publishing route, does self-publishing kind of complicate you trying to go the traditional publishing route now? Kind of like once it's out there, you know, as a traditional publisher going to ever pick it up again?
That one, I'm not sure. I feel like before I ever published, I feel like the answer would have been yes. Like, you do one or the other, and you can't like publish a book again with a publisher. But I feel like now that's not quite true. I think what'll happen is if they buy the rights or you repackage it, because I can think of a couple indie authors who did really well in indie publishing, and then when they got noticed, that's when they got a publishing deal. Or maybe they pick up books 2 and 3 in the series and not book 1. But I mean, even like, wasn't E.L. James, that was fan fiction, 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
So that was technically already out there before it ever was released as a published book. So, you know, obviously they had to take it down and, you know, scrub it right from the internet, but it was technically already out there.
Right. Interesting. Well, where is it available? And what forms is it in? Did you do audiobooks this time?
I did. I'm always doing audiobooks. I had debated, this one is a female lead, so I did it. I had debated doing every other book, the male leads as a male narrator. But then I was like, oh, I can't justify it. I have that skill set. You know what I mean? Like, I could do it too. I might as well. So I'll be doing all my own books. But yes, it's ebook, audiobook, print version. You can buy it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo. You can now buy the ebook on my website as well. I'm trying to figure out how to do audiobook downloads off my website, but you can buy it off roshni.net. Pretty much everywhere you buy books.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
So.
Well, good luck with that. So now you're going to take a big break, right? You're just going to take the summer off, right?
No. I got to get book 4 and get it in your hands so you can get mad at me again about drafts.
Yeah, right. I have to get my editing tools out again. But as a novelist, you're allowed to write this summer. As a screenwriter, you're not allowed to write this summer. I mean, obviously, you can write spec scripts, but you can't sell anything. You can't pitch anything. So, and that's because the writer's strike is in full swing. As of this recording, they have not settled anything. It's actually the
recording.
First week
this
of the
is
strike.
The first week of the strike. Yep. Great minds, man.
It's been the same thing. It's been interesting, hasn't it?
Oh my gosh.
I think that the Writers Guild did an excellent job of outlining what they wanted and why. And every time that the studios have come back with some retort or counter argument, the Writers Guild has been like so ready for it. Like they're like, you think this? No, that's not right. Because they had this whole thing about the AI stuff that we've talked about a lot. And they're like, the studios think they're going to like, well, this is our chance to just go all AI on our writing and stuff. And it's not making them look good at all. They think they have a new tool that's going to solve all their problems, but it's not. It's doing amazing things and it's getting better very quickly, but it's not what they think it's going to be.
Yeah. There was actually in the Hollywood Reporter, one of the many, oh my goodness, many, 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 many articles about the strike. And they asked the guild leaders, the Writers Guild leaders, why did the talks fail? This was going into the week. So the strikes, people hadn't started picketing yet. And the guild leader said that one of the things they talked about was AI, and that the studios were like, we don't want to put parameters on something we might want to use in the future. And all the writers were like, oh my God, we just got chills, you know? It's one of the funniest things to come out of the strike is go online on like Twitter and Instagram and look at the signs that people have made for the strike.
Oh, right.
Oh, they are hilarious. Like one is like, AI doesn't have daddy issues or whatever. And like, you know, stuff like that. And AI did not write this sign, or ChatGPT did write this sign. Like there's all these little like quippy things. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, hey, they're writers, right? They're using their skill on their signs.
I mean, it is really amazing where AI is and where it's going to be going. I mean, I think everyone's underestimated it to a great deal. I think I just shared with you a video of a game. Somebody had set up a scene of a game in a tavern, and their character was talking using just their voice to an NPC in a game. And that NPC was being run by ChatGPT and was interacting with the person as if that ChatGPT was in the room. Like, it was able to see the other characters in the room and talk about them, or even make up stories about the other characters in the room. and give advice to the player and stuff. I thought that was amazing. That was really kind of chilling to me, because that's like true interactivity and first person, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about, like, one of my coworkers was showing me an AI bot or whatever program editing in real time as you go. And of course, it's going to make things easy. But I was even thinking about AI has already been used in a lot of applications in regards to audiobook narration. And one of the really? Things it does is proofing, but it's not perfect. And so even if you run it through an AI proofer, you still have to check when it flags it and says, oh, this word is pronounced wrong or this phrase is missing. You still need a human to go back and make sure that it's correct. So it's not perfect. It saves you time, but you definitely have to check it for sure.
Right. But that's today, you know, it's going to get better and better. But it comes down to at the end is like, is it going to have, like you said, the daddy issue stuff? It's like a lot of our creativity, a lot of the stuff we write and generate and create games and everything has to do with our crises in life. In fact, I was just reading an article about the keys to good storytelling. And one of them was your story has to be like punishing. It has to like the stakes and the trials that your character have to go through have to be truly, you know, remarkable for the story to be interesting. Well,
yeah.
I don't know how AI is going to understand that because it hasn't lived it. It can read all the stories that are out there, but can it really understand what it means and like where's that line to draw kind of thing before you go too far kind of stuff?
Yeah.
I don't know if it can ever discern, you know, the humanity of a crisis of a situation like that.
It's,
you know,
it's
it can
so
put together
though.
Characters and plot lines and stories and stuff.
Yeah. But the actual like heart behind it is missing.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny though, because just a few episodes ago when we were talking about AI and we were talking about a potential strike, I mean, one of the things I said is, but I'm worried if they go on strike, it's just ushering in the age of AI that much faster.
That's a possibility.
Yeah.
The bigger question there is, you know, and I mentioned this on a thread I was on. It was like, Hollywood is a big union town. And all the other unions are watching the writer's strike. You know, the crew, the actors, the directors, the producers, even the producers who are kind of on the other side of this argument, you know, their decision-making could be taken away by AI.
Yeah.
If the AI could become the producer, and it already kind of is, because there is Largo AI is out there as a system that can read a script and based on its database of movies and results will tell you if it's going to be successful or not. You know, it's going to tell you how much money it's going to make and where, you know, how it's going to be released and what the budget should be. And, you know, it's kind of affecting everybody in Hollywood. So it's up to us as the people who are the creative heart of Hollywood to decide how much we want AI to do for us. And I don't think that one group in Hollywood should determine what AI does for another group. It's like, if we want to use AI as a tool to help us write and write better or, you know, faster, if that's the biggest problem, you know, great. But that's our tool to use. And, you know, it shouldn't impact us financially or, you know, career wise because of that. But for the producers or the studios to say, we're going to use that tool to replace you, that's not appropriate. Just like artists, like cinematographers or whatever, there's these, you know, doing editors, doing AI video editing. They might use AI as a tool for their editing, but it shouldn't replace them because those editors have the skills of how and when to cut and how to, you know, combine all these aspects. Same thing with the visual effects and the you know, the animation. All of those things are, you know, decisions that humans should make, and these are tools that they should use. And they shouldn't be used by other people to eliminate the roles that, you know, they see as, you know, cost effective or whatever.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And what a slap in the face to be told, oh, you know, we're worried about this one thing, and then have people say, okay, that's great that you're worried, but we still want it to be unlimited. You know, like, ouch, you know, like that's basically in effect saying, and if we want to replace you, we will totally replace you, you know. I think that was, yeah.
It's kind of the whole question of, you know, they came for these people and I said nothing, and they came for those people and I said nothing. and then they came for me and no one was there to stand up for me.
Yeah.
It's kind of that situation. Everyone thinks that AI is going to be the thing that helps them deal with their issues with other groups of people, but it can come back to bite you in the ass really fast.
No, it's true. You know, like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens. And I don't know.
I think that's going to be the biggest sticking point too. I think the other issues could be resolved. I think AI is going to be one of the biggest sticking points. Yeah.
What I'd be curious though is
the other things are logistical.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say though, what I would be curious though is, so right now any late night program has gone dark and SNL has gone dark because they rely on day to day writing. So, and they don't have scripts stockpiled, obviously.
Right.
I would be curious, it's only been a week as of this recording, but if this drags out, will they turn to AI to create, you know, projects? I'm already seeing on the breakdowns things like web series created by ChatGPT, and they're looking for actors. Or I believe I told you off podcast, I saw one that was like,
really?
This commercial has been completely done by AI, script, directing, the characters in it are AI. And you're like, great, you know? Like, all right, what are we even doing here, you know? So if it drags out, it's only been a week, but if it drags out, that's the issue.
Right. I mean, I don't think commercial writers are on strike. I don't think they are. Like, you know, people at ad agencies and copywriters, they're not on strike, are they? They're not part of the union at all.
Not necessarily. But my point is, if you're seeing it in places like, you know, do you want to do a web series written by ChatGPT? Do you want to do a commercial written by an AI bot? You know what I'm saying? You might not see it in TV and film, but if it's in commercial, it's going to trickle down. Why not?
I mean, it's kind of funny. It could get to the point where somebody brings you a script and you read it and you're like, oh, this is a great script. I'd love to do this. And you go film it. And later on, you learn that it was generated by AI. That's a theoretical possibility someday. It's a matter of who's keeping track, you know, it's kind of like the, was it a Robert De Niro movie where called Simone, and it was about an AI actor that he created and nobody knew it was an AI. And she was this big celebrity and he was the one running the simulation. And then the AI wanted to become its own person and kind of ruined his whole career. But the idea is that, who's to say that when somebody brings you a script and they say it was written by, you know, Tom Loveman, you know, who's a fictitious person. and you don't know that it really wasn't, you know, it was written 100% by AI. It's kind of like the, you know, I would say it's not plagiarism because it's not stealing it from someone else, but it's what if a real person put their name on an AI script and didn't tell anybody? That would be, you know, kind of a case to be adjudicated by the guild and the courts and whatever to see what does that mean, you know, if somebody tried to copyright a script written by AI.
I was going
to
say
that's right now
part of the thing too. Yeah, copyright, who owns things, you know, the whole shebang. It's messy. It's really messy.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting to see how that winds up this year, huh?
Yeah, I was going to say, so aside from you watching Hollywood implode over here, what are you up to this summer?
hopefully writing. I have spent a lot of time over the last year working on my writing skills, and I'm actually going to be trying to take one of my scripts that I wrote like 10 years ago and do a rewrite of it, and I have to do an update of it too because it's very dated for the time period I wrote it in. So I'm kind of excited to tackle that this summer and hopefully have that ready for it's one of the projects that is in the slate with my writing group, Get It Made. So I'd like to have that done in the next few months. So that's my big writing project for the summer.
Ooh, nice. Very
cool. It's a TV pilot.
Cool. Wow. So you've been doing a lot with Get It Made. Have you done anything regionally as far as getting involved with the regional film market?
You know, I've had talks with a basically the owner of a new studio here in Cleveland, and it's actually not in Cleveland. It's way out, kind of closer to where I live, actually, on the way out on the east side of Cleveland. We're actually kind of adjacent to the suburbs. I'm not exactly suburbs. I'm like just outside the suburbs, And he's even further out. And he and his wife are from LA, and they're in the process of moving here. They bought a out of service high school out in this town called Burton, Ohio, and are turning it into a studio with like standing sets and sound stages and production and post-production facilities. So I've been talking to him about what productions he has coming this summer, and possibly helping him out with like some working on either on productions or post-production with what's going on there. It's called Schoolyard Studios. It's kind of cool. It's pretty amazing what he's done there.
Huh.
You know, obviously they've got, you know, they can do any kind of production that takes place in a school because they have an entire school to work with. But they also have standing sets for like a courtroom and, you know, a hospital room and some other stuff that they're working on. I think they're working on a spaceship even for sci-fi stuff. So, you know, they've got this expansive, you know, location that they can cut up into different sizes and spaces and create these standing sets. So it'll be pretty neat, a resource to have in this area of Ohio, just outside Cleveland, for people who want to come here and film.
That's cool.
So hopefully nice. I'll be working on some productions there. Yeah, I'd be excited to do that.
Are there a lot of film incentives in Ohio, or?
I don't know what the current level is. It was like a $40 million, might have gone up to 75. But they do have a big tax incentive for Midwest. You know, they actually stole a lot of filming from your state, from Michigan, when they got rid of their tax credit. So yeah, they have a dozen or more productions a year going on here, and just in Northeast Ohio. I mean, the tax credit's for the whole state, but just we're pretty big up here in Ohio, Northeast Ohio.
Oh, nice.
But we haven't had a lot of production facilities. So this studio being developed here is pretty exciting, because most of the filming here was on location shooting stuff, less studio kind of production.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Huh. It's funny because when I left Michigan, they were trying to do the tax incentives, and they realized, because everyone was going out there to film, but they realized they didn't have the infrastructure. And so they started building stuff. And then at that point, the governor changed and he got rid of the incentives. So they had all these empty buildings and
right.
No one to use it. So hopefully you guys do better with that.
Yeah, I heard that. Was it New York City was going to hugely increase their tax incentive too? So a lot of competition in that area. They were going to be like $300-400 million or something in tax incentive. It's a lot of tax incentives. Well, everybody, thank you for listening this whole year. We really appreciate you. It's been an awesome season. We've had some great guests and great discussions, and we hope you've enjoyed it. Any final words, Narachni?
Oh, final words. That sounds so ominous. And we will see you guys in a few weeks or months. And hopefully everyone has an awesome summer.